Happy New Year, listeners, and welcome back to The Europeans. We've taken a break for a few weeks, but are back with a vengeance, bringing you some of the most fascinating and titillating stories from across Europe this week.
I don't know about titillating.
Yeah, I was going to say.
I mean, it depends how titillating you think the Bulgarian presidency of the EU is. Hello, everyone. Happy New Year. I've missed you, Dominic. How are you?
I've got the flu, like most other people in Europe at the moment, but I'm struggling on.
How was your Christmas? How were your holidays?
They were really nice, yeah. I was back in the UK doing all the English holiday things, and my Dutch husband, he's always a bit shocked by like how much of a schedule we have.
Yeah.
In the build-up and following Christmas, like all the things you have to do, because here in the Netherlands, they seem to just have a few days of family time and that's it. And it's chilled.
It's quite a military procedure in the Kramer household.
Yeah, it is. What about in the Lee household?
Yeah, no, mine was quite chill. It was a sort of pleasingly uneventful English Christmas. I did have quite a Parisian New Year, though. We had some French friends around, and me and my boyfriend, Alex, made a ill-advised cheese dish. So Alex is quite a big fan of YouTube cooking videos, and he'd found this recipe for like how to cover a brie with pastry. And you should not do this when there are French people there, listeners, because it really didn't go down well. We kind of cut this brie in half, filled it with like cranberries and nuts and stuff, wrapped it in pastry and wrote 2018 on the top.
Sounds disgusting.
These French friends were coming around and they really went for like New Year in a big traditional way. And one of them bought like foie gras pâté that his mum had made by hand. And we were just there with this stupid cheese. And there was this one girl who looked a bit like I'd stabbed her in the heart when I offered it to her. So yeah, that was a kind of interesting cultural experience, but it was very nice. And I'm really, really happy to be back here with the podcast. It's going to be a great year. I'm very excited about it.
It sure is. Now, I imagine many of our diehard fans are listening again.
Yes, many.
But for those of you who are listening afresh, we thought you might like to know a little bit about why we are here, why we started this podcast, and what we hope to do with it. Katie, take it away.
I'll explain who we are, first of all. So I'm Katie Lee. I am a journalist based in Paris. And you and I have been friends for a very long time, Dominic.
We have, reluctantly.
We both live in Europe. You live in Amsterdam, where you are a singer. I don't know why I'm doing your biography for you. You could probably do it yourself. And we talk about Europe a lot, you know? What we thought we'd do is call each other up every week and talk about what's been going on around the continent, and also call up people from all kinds of different countries so you can find out what's been going on where they are. And in our own kind of modest way, I guess, just try and bring the continent together a little bit more.
Aww. So, Katie, when the clock struck 12, were you most excited about the new European Green Capital, Nijmegen, or the European Capital of Sport, Sofia, or the Joint Cultural Capitals of Europe, Valletta and Leeuwarden, Friesland?
All of them? I don't know. What's the right answer? What was the first one?
The Green Capital of Europe.
What is that?
I don't know. The capital of greenness. But in all seriousness, it's also the year of the Bulgarian presidency, or the first 6 months of the Bulgarian presidency.
Yes, we have our resident Bulgarian expert, Georgi Gotev, on the line to talk about what we can expect from Bulgaria running the show in the European Union for the next 6 months. That is more exciting than it sounds, I promise.
We will then be moving on to a pan-European topic, looking at life expectancy across the EU.
Life expectancy, I feel, is relevant because you're very sick right now. Sorry, that's really morbid, isn't it?
I am very sickly, but I hope I'm not going to die.
Me too, otherwise this podcast is going to be a disaster. Next, we are going to be speaking Luxembourgish with Nina Lamparski, a language that you possibly didn't know existed, but is seeing something of a comeback.
It did sound a bit like a made-up name for a language.
It's real.
Like, if someone said, what do they speak in Luxembourg? I'd be like, I don't know, Luxembourgish?
Promise you, it is real, and Nina is going to tell us all about it.
Can't wait. And then we'll finish with my happy ending, of course.
Bringing up the rear. Bulgaria is calling the shots, Dominic, at the European Union. Now, there is a sexy sentence if ever I heard one. Bulgaria has just taken over the presidency of the EU, which is something that rotates every 6 months. They've taken over from Estonia, who had a very kind of tech-savvy, digital kind of 6 months where they focus a lot on technology. Now, I've got to confess that I've always been kind of unclear on what it means to be president of the EU.
Oh, that's really embarrassing for you, Katie.
So embarrassing. I know, I'm just a moron. It basically means you can, to some extent, set the priorities for what the EU is going to be doing for the next few months. And yeah, this is going to be a really interesting time. Obviously, there's a busy, busy 6 months coming up for the European Union, not least because of Brexit, a word that we try not to use very often on this podcast. Just once. That's all right, isn't it?
Forgiven.
Thanks.
It's somewhat controversial that Bulgaria have this presidency because, according to Transparency International's Corruption Perceptions Index, they are the most corrupt country in the EU. And they're one of the two countries with Romania who are under special monitoring by the EU to make sure that they are brought into line with European norms. They'll be watched very closely during these 6 months to see whether things have changed or whether things can continue to change. Let's speak to Gheorghe and find out more.
Yes, Gheorghe Gotev. He is pretty much the perfect person to talk to about this. He is Bulgarian. He is Belgian. He calls himself a Bulgarian. And yeah, he is a journalist with Euractiv, which is a multilingual European news website. And he's devoting himself a lot over the next 6 months to really covering the presidency and everything that's going on during that. So let's give him a call. Hi, Gheorghe.
Hi.
Hey, how are you?
Fine. I don't have a camera. That's all.
That's fine by me. Listen, it's been a very long day, and frankly, I don't want either of you to see me.
And I've got the flu, so yeah, it's lucky we're not doing TV today.
We've got faces for radio, I think it's fair to say.
Oh, rude. So do you think that the Bulgarian presidency could have any kind of positive effect on Bulgaria?
Yes, of course, because the presidency is giving a lot of people the idea that this is the right time to protest and say that people are unhappy and point out that deficiencies in the country. There was a protest just yesterday. Some activists in northwestern Bulgaria, which is the European Union poorest region, they staged a protest collecting signatures for a referendum for independence like Catalonia.
Oh, wow. Another big issue that a lot of people think of, sadly, when it comes to Bulgaria is corruption, right? Like, corruption is a big problem for a lot of Bulgarians on a day-to-day basis. People having to pay bribes and things like that, it's very, very common. Do you think maybe being under more scrutiny right now might help things like that get sorted out?
Certainly. The protest of, independence of northwestern Bulgaria has a motive that they wanted to get rid of corruption. It's depressing. I mean, the situation has only worsened. And it's not about only about corruption. It's also about freedom of the press. When Bulgaria joined the European Union, it was ranked 36 worldwide in terms of World Press Index. Now it's 109th. Almost the whole of Africa is in a better position than Bulgaria.
I've seen some surveys suggesting that the European Union is quite popular within Bulgaria, but the Bulgarian government is not that popular. Do you think the government is hoping that some of this European stardust will rub off onto them and they'll, being on the world stage, that the government will become more popular?
European stardust.
the thing is that in Bulgaria, and I also think in Romania, I know Romania very well. I'm Bulgarian, I made my studies in Romania. In both countries, I think the vast majority of the population trust much more the European Commission than their own governments, much more. This is not the case for the vast majority of European countries.
No, it's often the other way around.
To a Brit, that sounds very strange. I saw that on the list of priorities for Bulgaria during the presidency is going to be helping neighbouring countries in Eastern Europe and the Balkans with their bids to join the European Union. What's in it for Bulgaria? Why would they want to see more of their neighbours join?
If you look at the map, you will notice that the natural way for Bulgarians to reach Western Europe is just by crossing through Serbia, but Serbia is not in the European Union. It costs a huge, you know, amount to call from Sofia to someone in on a mobile phone, someone in Serbia. It costs like €3 a minute.
Wow.
If those countries were in the European Union, you know, it costs next to nothing.
I was wondering if you could think of any positive things that Bulgaria has to offer the EU in this position. So, like, everyone's talking about the corruption, the problems with the judiciary there, but I'm sure there are some great things about Bulgaria that they've got to give this great continent of ours.
Thank you so much for this question. You know, Bulgaria is very pro-European, actually, and there is not a single European policy Bulgaria doesn't wish to join. It is prevented from joining some of them, like Schengen, because some countries are against it. But Bulgaria is not a troublemaker in the European Union these days. I think Poland and Hungary are much bigger troublemakers. Yeah.
I've read a list of tips for Eurocrats that are going to be heading to Sofia because as part of the presidency, there's going to be a lot of meetings over there in Bulgaria. And one I really loved, and like, this was news to me, was that Bulgarians apparently shake their heads when they mean yes, which can cause a lot of confusion, you know, particularly in restaurants when like you're trying to get a glass of water and the waiter just kind of silently shakes his head at you. What would be your tips for Eurocrats heading to Bulgaria?
The worst mistake a Westerner makes in Bulgaria is when sometimes they ask when the Bulgarians are going to abandon the Russian alphabet. Actually, the Russian alphabet is the Bulgarian alphabet. The Bulgarians have created the Cyrillic alphabet.
Uh-huh.
It's the other way around. The Russians use the Bulgarian alphabet.
Ha! Russians, you've been told.
So, now on to life expectancy, or as the European Commission like to call it, healthy life years. So it's been a hot topic in the past few days, mainly due to some rather disturbing figures coming from the USA, showing that life expectancy has fallen for the second year in a row. This decrease is only marginal, but the last time there were two consecutive years of falling were in the 1960s.
Oh, wow.
It got me curious about what's going on in the EU. So, I did some research and I found that the European Commission released their 2018 aging report towards the end of last year. And I must say it's not the easiest read, but there are some juicy bits that are worth looking at. And they do have some very interesting data about the differences in life expectancy across the continent.
Did you literally read the whole thing?
I mean, I skim read it, but I mainly read the stuff about life expectancy, if I'm honest.
No, that's more than I did. Well done.
Thank you. So the bottom line is that between 1960 and 2015, both males and females across the EU have seen their life expectancy increase by around 10 years.
That's quite a lot.
It is, isn't it? Yeah. However, it's kind of flattening out, flatlining. No, not flatlining, what's it called? Plateauing. It's levelling off right now, and that's partly because there have been huge improvements in mortality amongst young people, and that affects the average much more than the smaller changes in healthcare for older people. There is a wide discrepancy between different EU member states. For example, in 2015, life expectancy at birth for females ranged from 78.2 in Bulgaria to 85.8 in Spain.
Wow.
Which is really quite a big difference. And for males, the biggest difference is between Lithuania, where they can on average live to 69.2, and in Sweden, where they can live on average to 80.4.
So we definitely got kind of Eastern European countries bringing up the rear on this one. But I was kind of surprised to see Spain at the top. Like, why do people live so long in Spain?
Yeah, I mean, it's so difficult to know exactly why. And in some ways, it's a bit reductive to say that, yeah, the poorer countries in the east of Europe, people have a lower income, so therefore they don't live as long, because it's more complicated than that. And I mean, if you look at The Spirit Level by Kate Pickett and Richard Wilkinson, they claim that actually education and inequality have more of an effect on life expectancy than the differences in income.
Mm.
And I think there are other like policies and cultural traditions that can really affect life expectancy, like smoking habits, policies around drinking and exercise.
Just because you're rich doesn't mean you're going to have really good life expectancy.
Yeah, it's not as simple as that. Something else I found interesting from this report was that it seems that often the figures underestimate how long the average age is going to be. And if you underestimate it seriously, then it seems to me that that's a bigger problem for society than if you overestimate, because it means you've suddenly got a much bigger aging population that need looking after. If anything, they should be making out that people are going to live slightly longer than they think.
We shouldn't be encouraging people to massage statistics, Dominic. That's not our policy here at the Europeans.
A really interesting thing I found out was that this aging expert, Dr. Aubrey de Grey, believes that the first person to live to 1,000 years old has already been born.
Oh, shut up. And that's ridiculous.
Yeah, science will find a way to perfect anti-aging treatments within the next 20 years. And yeah, so perhaps all this talk about people living until 80 or 90 is totally irrelevant.
It could be you.
It is me.
Or they've got really bad cold. Sorry, I should stop making jokes about this. It's really morbid.
Wherever you live, it's just an average. It doesn't really mean anything. But it is something that politicians look at. And I think in America, particularly, seeing that it's gone down 2 years in a row, politicians should look at that and think, okay, why is it decreasing?
I read a study about why the US life expectancy is lower than Europe, which was quite interesting, by the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, admittedly using slightly older data than you've got to hand in your lovely report there. And it was saying it was mostly because of guns, car crashes, and drug poisonings. So that's some stuff for you to fix, America.
One final comment from me is the discrepancy between the east of Europe and the rest of Europe in terms of life expectancy made me think of the studies that came out last year looking at how various multinational food companies were subtly selling like budget, cheaper versions of supposedly the same food, like pizzas with cheaper and less healthy ingredients in the east of the continent than in the rest of the continent. I wonder whether that's having an effect, hey?
So give me some examples of your famous food racism. It is really scandalous.
For example, a Dr. Oetker margarita pizza comes with 7 slices of mozzarella in Austria and only 5 in Slovakia. Not only that, but the Austrians get tomato paste and the Slovakians only get tomato concentrate. Isn't that horrible?
It is horrible. I don't think fixing it will deal with the whole like east-west life expectancy crisis, but it is genuinely really awful and we need to get this fixed. Just a final note, wherever you are in Europe, I would love to hear your kind of spurious tips for long life. Drink 3 pints of Guinness a day.
In Italy, it's the olive oil.
Or in France, just eating insane amounts of cheese and smoking thousands of cigarettes. It's probably not that. Schwätze mehr oder über Luxembourgisch, Dominic?
Oh, yeah. Loads?
No, I just said, now let's talk about Luxembourgish.
Oh, I thought you said, did you speak Luxembourgish?
Close enough. Yeah, Luxembourgish. Did you know that was a language?
No.
I'm lucky enough to have 2 colleagues who speak Luxembourgish. And the first time I heard Jacques speaking Luxembourgish, I didn't think it was a real language. Like, I thought he was making it up. And Nina, who we're just about to speak to, said that her colleague thought she was just, I think, speaking German, but drunk.
Oh.
Yeah, Luxembourgish is a language.
Are you sure we're not just being punked?
No, we're not being punked. It's a real thing. Luxembourgish is a language and it is making a comeback, baby. Apparently, maybe. I read in the Guardian newspaper that this language, which is on the list of UNESCO endangered languages, is making a comeback.
Well, it must be true then.
Well, we weren't really sure. So I asked my 2 Luxembourgish friends about it and neither of them had really heard of this comeback. But it's very good news for them, you know, now that they've read it and it's definitely true. The culture ministry says that like loads more people are learning it than were learning it a decade ago. So to explain all of this to us, we're going to call Nina Lamparski, a real live Luxembourger.
Hi, Nina.
Hi, Nina.
Schöne guten Abend und ihr zwei, Maya.
Oh, and to you too.
Thank you. That was the right answer. That was Luxembourgish. And that said, hello to you two.
Nina, just before I called you, Dominic was like, what, you mean she actually speaks the language? Like, I think maybe a part of you, Dom, didn't think that Luxembourgish was real. Is that fair to say?
I mean, maybe, yeah, maybe I hadn't ever heard of it. It's very rude of me to claim that it might be a made-up language, but I hear it's growing.
It is growing, and actually you're not rude at all. In fact, most people I meet can't believe that there's a language called Luxembourgish, and you're definitely the majority, I think. But yeah, so we've got this amazing action plan now in Luxembourg to revive and preserve and grow our language.
So did you grow up speaking it at home? How did it work?
So yeah, so you speak it at home, and then in school You learn it when you're in primary school, but you also learn German and French, and most Luxembourgers will speak at least three languages.
Wow.
But my year was actually the first year back in the mid-1980s. My year was the first year where Luxembourgish actually became a national language. So before that, you would speak it, but it, you know, the two main languages are French and German. And then I was the lucky one to actually, I actually had to sit an exam. And it was one of the only exams in my life where I got caught cheating.
You cheated on your Luxembourgish exam?
Oh, no.
I did, because it's really hard. It's quite difficult because I spoke German at home as well. And because it's quite similar to German, but yeah, and the rules are quite difficult. Sorry, Mr. Morris, if you're listening.
Oh, my God. When I listen to it, it does sound to me a lot like German. How different is it?
And quite like Dutch, actually.
Yeah.
Mainly it evolved from a German dialect spoken along the Moselle River. So the wine growers in that region spoke something called the Moselle Franconian dialect. And then over time it became, you know, Luxembourg sort of grew its own distinct language from that. And Germans, in fact, they can probably read it quite easily if they see it in written form. But when they hear it, if somebody speaks very quickly, and depending on where they're from in Luxembourg, it'll still be quite hard in the beginning to learn because, yeah, I mean, it sounds like you've got potatoes in your cheeks. But it's not very pretty. It's funny, but I don't think it's very Shakespearean. I don't think you'll ever hear anyone say, oh, my God, that Luxembourgish language is just so beautiful.
So if you go into a shop in like a village in Luxembourg, so not in a city, what language would you expect to speak with the shopkeeper there?
Most likely Luxembourgish, and they'll reluctantly speak French and German. Yeah, I mean, most Luxembourgers will speak those three languages. So I think we've always been pulled in those two directions. Like, on the one hand, we've got the Luxembourgish tradition, and it is like it's a very old country. It goes back to 963, so it's got a very fascinating history. Lots of people try to conquer it. But then at the same time, we're also, you know, nearly half of our population is foreign. So there's always been sort of the multiculturalism versus this very kind of unique cultures. But apparently, and I guess, you know, it is time to use the horrible word of Brexit.
Oh, no.
It was going so well, yeah.
Sorry. But basically, numbers of people learning Luxembourgish have gone up. And in fact, Brexit is one of the reasons why. You know, you can live in Luxembourg for years and never speak it because you don't really need it. But if you want to have citizenship, then you need to pass a Luxembourgish language test. And so quite a lot of people have now signed up for classes because they, you know, they want to basically become Luxembourgers.
How many people are learning? Like, I've read in The Guardian that more than 6,500 people were learning last year, which apparently is twice as many as a decade ago.
It's record numbers. There's hundreds of courses being offered now. And there are all of these initiatives. So this year they're bringing out an online Luxembourgish dictionary. And they want to create a Luxembourgish academy. They're lobbying for the EU to recognize Luxembourgish as one of the official languages, which obviously, I mean, there's only, what, there's 500,000 of us. So it's symbolic more than anything else. Perhaps with sort of this weird revival of regionalism and nationalisms around Europe, perhaps this could be a positive side to it, you know, people learning this weird language and kind of getting to know these people who are, you know, we've got really weird sayings. So the language is actually quite an agricultural language. You can still tell its roots. So one of the phrases that we, for example, have is "den dummste Bauer fand die dickste Gromperen," which means "the dumbest farmer finds the biggest potatoes."
I imagine it's quite a popular policy.
I mean, I suppose, yes. I mean, it's better that way than the other way around if they try to sort of take it away as a national language.
Yes.
Like, I think then that, you know, people would definitely be up in arms. Our Prime Minister has done, I think, quite a lot to push Luxembourg into the international spotlight because he's very young. He lives with another man. In fact, his first act when he became Prime Minister was to legalize gay marriage in Luxembourg. So I think there's also sort of, from where I'm sitting anyway, there was, you know, a wind of change blowing through the country anyway, which is nice. And so, yeah, this does feel like a sort of, it feels like a modernizing initiative rather than something that's, you know, about clinging on to old values for the sake of that. Also get the language to grow. Obviously, this is one of the problems when it's a language that's not spoken by many people and dying out. You need to make sure that it's obviously being modernized. And so I think this is definitely an initiative that will help it to kind of move into the, you know, the next decade.
Fewer sayings about potatoes and more kind of cool internet slang.
I wouldn't count on it. I think there'll always be potatoes.
So, listeners, I'm sorry to have to start the year with a moan at the beginning of my happy ending, but I have to get something off my chest. A few days ago, Katie Lee sent me an unsolicited suggestion for this week's happy ending, even though my happy ending is meant to be a surprise for her. She really doesn't understand it, do you?
Oh, come on.
Not only was this breaking our journalistic integrity, Katie, the story that you suggested was by no means happy news.
I was just trying to be helpful.
Well, yeah, it wasn't helpful and it was wrong. You were referencing the news that the world's most expensive bottle of vodka had been stolen from a bar in Copenhagen. Explain yourself.
Well, Dominic, actually, I can justify the fact that this is good news because the vodka bottle has been found. Let's start the story from the beginning. There's a bar in Copenhagen called Cafe 33, and they had a really bad week last week when it emerged that this insanely expensive bottle of vodka worth $1.3 million had been stolen. It is the bottle itself is made of gold and silver. It has a diamond-encrusted cap, as seen in season 3 of House of Cards, where the now disgraced Kevin Spacey is seen drinking it. And this is really bad news for the bar specifically because they'd only borrowed it. It wasn't theirs. And it wasn't even insured.
Oh, that's so awkward.
Super awkward. But it has just been found on a building site. And guess what?
What?
Somebody has drunk the vodka and unbelievably left the insanely expensive bottle itself with its diamond encrusted cap.
So it's not good news.
Well, they can just fill it up with some kind of supermarket own brand. It'll be fine.
No one will ever know.
It is good news for the bar owner, this guy called Brian Ingberg, who told a Danish newspaper, "I feel fantastic. The vodka god saved us." So it's really very good news for him that it's been found. The vodka itself is gone. It's very bad news for the thief in that they didn't realise the bottle was the crazy expensive bit. So they should really have nicked that bit. But they might have had a nice time drinking the vodka. I don't know.
So does that mean there's like a Europe-wide manhunt still out there for this vodka stealer? I wonder whether Interpol have been informed.
We should probably call them.
I did actually find a real piece of good news that we should all be celebrating this week. From the 1st of January, employers in Iceland are legally required to pay men and women equally if they're doing the same job. Now, I think that's something to celebrate, and I think you should take a leaf out of my book in finding stories that are happy.
I am very happy for you, Iceland. I think, do you know what we should do to celebrate? Is crack open a nice big bottle of vodka.
Well, that's it. And maybe that's it for me for the rest of the podcast because Katie thinks I'm going to die.
Don't say that. I now feel really bad for saying that. You're not going to die. Is it too early for me to ask for potential other co-hosts to send in their applications? Listen, this podcast is going to go huge this year with you and me, Dominic. We are sticking together. You're going to get through this. You're going to fight through this cold and we're going to make this podcast huge. We have big plans for it. Listeners, help us spread the word. Tweet about it. Facebook about it. Go into the streets of your village in Luxembourg and shout to the world. It's amazing to see us gathering, you know, listeners in all kinds of places from Germany to where? Sweden.
We will be back again next week with all the latest juicy gossip from Europe, which might include some more Luxembourg news, actually, because there's a big case, isn't there, about the Luxembourg leaks.
Oh, is that happening next week?
Yeah, I think so.
Oh, cool. Well, maybe we'll be talking about that then. We can get Nina back. Lucky you, Nina. If you have time, please write us a review on iTunes. It really helps people to find us. And in the meantime, you can find us all over the internet. We are on Twitter at EuropeansPod. We are on Instagram at EuropeansPodcast. And our website is EuropeansPodcast.com.
If you have any suggestions or feedback, then we are always open to receiving a nice little email. And if you'd like to appear on the show as a guest because you've got something particularly interesting that's going on in your neck of Europe, then also get in touch. EuropeansPodcast@gmail.com. We'd like to thank Jim Barn, our awesome composer who created these wonderful European jingles.
Including the new Dominic's Happy Ending jingle, which you heard this week. Send us your thoughts about the sheep noises.
New year, new jingle.
And thank you to Georgi Gota from Euractiv. Do follow his website, bulgarianpresidency.eu. And thank you as well to my lovely friend and colleague, the exotic Luxembourger, Nina Lamparski. And thank you for listening. We'll see you next week.
Bye.
Bye. Oh,
my voice really did sound fluey there.
Bye.
I mean, you've already given us the potato phrase, but do you have any other tongue twisters in Luxembourgish that we could put at the end of the podcast after the credits?
I've actually got two.
She's come prepared.
Basically, one is a very short one, which sounds like I'm yodeling, which is Lidiludilo, yodiludilidlo.
Wow.
It means, is that light on? Yes, that light is on. And the other one is slightly less PC. It is Van Herendicken, Eisendicken, Enke, Dicke, Van Nant, Van Nant, Eisendicken, Erendicken, Zulein, Dicke, Viserendicken, Eisendicken, Emi, Dicke, Van Nant. Which means, if your fat kid calls our fat kid fat one more time, then our fat kid will call your fat kid fat for as long until your fat kid stops calling our kid fat.